Blog Talk Radio.
Broadcasting to the world. Broadcasting to the world.
BlakeRadio.com. Music for your mind, body, and soul. Talk radio at its best. You're listening to Rainbow Soul from BlakeRadio.com.
Greetings. It's so nice to spend time with my listening audience this evening. I'm Deirdre Schuler, and this is Topically Yours on the Blake Radio Network, Rainbow Soul. And, you know, I want to take a moment to thank all of those in military who are fighting to protect this country. You know, last night on David Letterman, the First Lady, Michelle Obama, reminded us that we should take the time to pray for military personnel who are risking their lives to protect this country. So if you know a military family, offer to do something nice for them. Mow the lawn or pick up groceries or just do something to say you appreciate their sacrifice. I personally pray that wars will end and the world will find better ways of ironing out their differences. Well, my show today is going to take us back in history. World War II, to be exact, when women were recruited into the military. In fact, on May 28, 1941, Congresswoman Edith Rogers introduced a bill establishing a Women's Army Auxiliary Corps. And on May 14, 1942, the bill to establish a Women's Army Auxiliary Corps became law, and Ovida Culp Hobby, the wife of the former governor of Texas, was named director. In fact, these military nurses were very much involved in the turmoil at Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941. Women were being trained as nurses at the first WAAC training center in Fort Des Moines, Iowa. And with a nudge from Eleanor Roosevelt, the Navy got its act together and began authorizing a woman's naval reserve, and the Marines followed suit. So on today's show, I have invited playwright and critic Jeffrey Sweet and actress and playwright Nambi Kelly to talk about Mr. Sweet's play, Court Martial at Fort Devens. This play parallels a real-life event that involved African-American women during World War II who joined the Army to be trained as nurses but found themselves instead relegated to latrine duty. Miss Nambi Kelly portrays a central character in this off-Broadway play produced by Woody King Jr. in association with the Castillo Theater located at 543 West 42nd Street in Manhattan. And as you can hear, one of my guests is Nambi Kelly, who was born in New York, and she grew up in Chicago, where she couldn't help but love the business of entertainment. Her father is a filmmaker, documentarian, and a professor emeritus of history. Her stepmother chairs the dance department at Williams College in Massachusetts. Kelly earned a bachelor's degree from the Theater School of DePaul University, and ever since she has alternated playwriting with acting. Jeffrey Sweet is a writer, journalist, songwriter, critic, lyricist, director, and theater historian. Sweet has been a playwright, screenwriter, teacher, and sometimes songwriter. He's a resident member of Chicago's Victorian Garden Theater, where 13 of his plays, including Flyovers, The Action Against Saul, Schumann, The Value of Names, Berlin 45, With and Without, Court Martial at Fort Devon, and Bluff, have been produced. Well, I have both Miss Kelly and Mr. Sweet awaiting in the wings. So I'll just let them come out for themselves and say hello. So welcome to the show, Miss Kelly and Mr. Sweet.
Glad to be here.
Thank you.
Oof, that introduction was a mouthful. But I didn't, you know, there was, I wanted to touch on some things before about your lives. And, you know, I understand, Mr. Sweet, that your father was a science writer who aided Supreme Court Justice Earl Warren in drafting two anti-McCarthy speeches. All kinds of exciting things seem to have happened in your household.
My dad actually had three history degrees and was trying to be a history professor, but somebody gave him a class, and he discovered that he wasn't a very good teacher, which sort of broke his heart. And then he got hired by Northwestern University to write about science for them, and then he went to the University of Chicago and spent the rest of his career writing about science for them. But along the way, he was in D.C., and he became friendly with Chief Justice Warren, and Warren said, hey, I've got these speeches that I'm trying to put together. Will you help me with them? And they turned out to be two of the most open anti-McCarthy speeches that were given in that time, notable because, of course, Warren was sitting on the Supreme Court. So this was something my dad was very proud of. But, you know, this the sense of being involved in history has probably I got from my dad. So.
Well, you know, wasn't it kind of dangerous back then to be anti-McCarthy because he was just had a hit list?
Yeah, no, he. But you got a little bit of cover if you were if you were hanging out with Chief Justice Warren. You know, I don't think he was in any great danger. But it was just helping Warren write this. But and remember too that members of McCarthy's own party were not exactly thrilled with what he did. Eisenhower loathed McCarthy because McCarthy had attacked one of Eisenhower's best friends, General Marshall. So Eisenhower was working behind the scenes with fellow party members as well as with the Democrats to get rid of McCarthy. McCarthy was, you know, very dangerous to everybody because he was utterly reckless. But along the way, he did manage to destroy a lot of lives.
I know he targeted Hollywood.
Oh, yeah. Well, you're talking now about another play I wrote called The Value of Names, which is about the blacklist and the aftermath of the blacklist and people who lost their livings in Hollywood because of their liberal or progressive affiliations. In fact, that play is running in St. Louis right now, The Value of Names.
Do you intend to bring that to New York? Because that sounds interesting.
Well, it's been done in New York in the area a few times. A few years ago, Jack Klugman, in fact, starred in it at the George Street Playhouse in New Brunswick, New Jersey, and he played it actually in Queens and elsewhere in the area. So there's some talk about trying to put that back together again for New York, although, alas, not with Jack, who doesn't seem to be physically up to doing an eight performance a week run anymore. But I'd love to see that one come back.
Well, aren't you doing? Is there a recent one you just did called Class Dismissed?
Yeah, that was in Chicago. That was kind of an oddball play that I wrote about how the state of Vermont went from being a very conservative state to being a very liberal state. There was an article in a magazine back in the early 70s that said that if the right 500,000 people moved to Vermont, the politics of the state would flip over, and that's exactly what happened. And that's how we got Bernie Sanders and Ben and Jerry's and a lot of other stuff. But I mean, it's basically a personal story. It's not just about politics, but I seem to find myself very interested in personal stories in the middle of political and historical contexts. Although I sometimes just write, you know, silly stuff because I like comedy. Court Martial of Art Devens has got a few laughs in it, but I wouldn't call it a comedy. It's very close to the truth of what happened. Nambi is playing a character based very closely on a real woman named Alice Young, And the only reason I changed the name was because I had a scene between this character and her father, and I didn't know whether Alice Young's real father was in the picture at the time. So I changed the name so as not to put anything out there that might not be true. But almost everything in the play that the character does, it occurs to me that we haven't said anything about what the play is about.
I was just about to say to talk about it, because I was going to ask you, how did you find out about this? Because there's so much unknown and forgotten history. How did you come to know the history of this court-martial?
Well, it was absolutely an accident. A number of years ago, I was researching something else, and in 1945, March 1945 edition of the New York Herald Tribune, looking at it on microfilm, and there was a story that I started reading on the front page, and at the bottom of the first part of the story, it said continued on page, 14. So I cranked to page 14, looking for the continuation of the story, and down in the right-hand bottom corner, I remember it vividly, it was a little two-paragraph story with the headline, Four Colored Girls to be Tried for Mutiny. And I thought, hello, I've never heard about this. So I wanted to see why they were being tried. And it turned out they were being tried because they had pulled a strike against the United States Army, and I wanted to read more, and I kept cranking through that New York Herald Tribune, and there wasn't much in there. So I thought, well, probably the black press would have more of this story. So I went up to the Schomburg Center, and it was front page news on most of the black newspapers at the time. And they indeed were court-martialed because they pulled a strike against the army when their colonel just insulted them horribly. He had also taken them from the program that they had enrolled in. They had joined the army on the promise that they were going to be not nurses actually, but medical technicians. And this guy one day is walking through a corridor, and he sees this young woman, in real life Alice Young, who has put a thermometer into the mouth of a white soldier, and he throws a fit. He discovers that there's a whole detachment of young black women who are putting thermometers into white boys' mouths, and he says, not in my hospital. And he instantly yanked them out of that program, handed them mops, and said, you're colored, this is what you know how to do. Well, of course, they were furious about that. They had a meeting with him, and he got up, and instead of being at all conciliatory, he just insulted them further to the point that they broke ranks, ran from the room. Some of them tried to slug him, they pulled a strike against the army. A general was in the neighborhood, came in to visit them, stood up in front of them, and said, "Look, we're going to forget all about this if you go back to work." And most of them went back to work, but in real life, four of them said, no, go ahead and court-martial us, even though to be court-martialed for this, it was technically desertion. They could have been shot. Mm-hmm. So I got my hands on the transcript of the court-martial and was found it just astonishing material. And indeed, in the play, most of the dialogue is edited out of the transcript. It's what they really say. Many of the lines that Nambi is saying were things that Alice Young, in fact, said.
Well,
so
I want to ask Nambi about her role as Jenny Boyd, which is the name that you replaced Miss Young's name with, right?
Right, yeah.
So, Nambi, what intrigued you about the role?
Well, I have been blessed to often get to play historical characters, and I really love researching things and finding out things, and this was a story that I didn't know about, and so I was just intrigued to find the history. And I actually did find some stuff online that were from white newspapers, but it was actually sort of fascinating was that they all had different facts. So like one would say, The panel had nine people on it, and there were no blacks on the panel. And then another newspaper would say there were 12 people on the panel, and three of them were blacks. And it was just crazy, like, how different the stories were from paper to paper.
You're talking about the court-martial panel, right?
Yeah, the court-martial panel. And I guess one of them actually stated that when the women were, oh, I don't want to give away the play. Let me stop there. Well, I'll stop there. But it's very interesting, the response as they were going through it.
Which one do you think was factual? Were there any black people at that time on the panel?
From what I've read, there were, because I think they wanted to make a big PR show that this wasn't a racial matter. They wanted to say that the black officers would vote to convict as well. So I think it was that doesn't isn't a big part of the play, though, simply because we didn't have enough actors to play a panel. But
well, the black woman officer was that real or
yes.
That was just. Oh, really?
Oh, yes. Tenola Stoney. We use her real name, and everything that she said and says in the court comes out of the transcript. She was a remarkable person. So I don't think it's giving away too much to say that it ends, oddly enough, it ends in victory. It's they end up prevailing, but how they end up prevailing, how they end up winning, is part of what's fascinating to me, at any rate. They actually beat this colonel in 1945,
which is almost unheard of.
Oh, you can't find another case remotely like it from the time. These women were absolutely, without any power or political might or anything, and yet they prevailed. But to tell you how they prevailed would be to reveal some of the surprises in the story. But a lot of it has to do with the way the women in question behaved during the court martial and what they said during the court martial. I will tell you that the defense attorney did an unusual thing in that he put somebody who would have ordinarily be a prosecution witness on the stand, and her testimony ended up being the testimony most useful to the defense, which is
also
pretty unlikely.
I want to ask Nami about this, because it just seems that the word they used that was so offensive is a very preferred term now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Don't
I
you find that kind of rather interesting?
It took me a minute to actually sort of register it. I was like, wait, that's not a big deal. But,
exactly.
As we're doing the play, in my mind, I replaced the word because it doesn't have the same charge for me or my generation. So I do replace the word in my imagination with all kinds of things, But, yeah, the term black, which I did not know that. My father, as you have pointed out, he's a historian, he's a revolutionary in the 60s, and so when I was growing up, all we heard was black power, red, black, and green,
mm-hmm.
Exactly. all this pride, and we had to know all the words to lift every voice and sing, So for me, I'm always proud, and even when the term African-American, well, it went Afro-American from what I remember, and then African-American, I still was like, well, I'm black. I just call myself black. I mean, a lot of people in my age group do, but it was like, oh, really? That's not a good thing? And so, it wasn't a good thing at that time.
I did not know that. And the interesting thing about that, I was thinking about that when I was watching the play. I loved it, by the way, is that a lot of young people will say, huh?
Because
they won't get that.
No, that was one of the most difficult things, was how do you establish that what we consider to be, a positive term today back in the 40s was considered an insult. And I had to figure out how to establish that. Indeed, it's a scene between the colonel and the white female lieutenant who says, you can't say that. That's insulting. Language evolves. But one of the things that sort of forget is that the term is black. Black is a term of pride and identification, really pretty much kicked in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
It was, with black power, with, the songs that appropriated the word. Before that, the polite word was Negro, which we almost never hear anymore now.
Because almost that could be considered offensive now.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Nabi's father actually said to me that, from his perspective, that's a cultural error, that there's nothing, from his perspective, offensive about the term.
Well, I mean, in today's, we're talking about in how youth or younger people would view that today.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, when you hear Negro today, a lot of younger people think, oh, Uncle Tom.
Mm-hmm.
If they even know the term Uncle Tom. You
know what I mean? It's just, and what
along
were
those
they
lines
back then?
Of,
colored? Were they considered colored? What was the
Well,
the,
that was considered to be a polite term, you know. Mm-hmm. At one point, as you may remember, the defense attorney talks to the black lieutenant, Lieutenant Stoney, and says, "You are a colored lady," and of course the NAACP, you know, is the CP stands for colored people, and at that point that was considered a polite term, and it's gone through a change in which that's considered again to be an Uncle Tom term, but now the people invert the words to people of color.
Mm-hmm.
Now it means
exactly
something else. So we're in the middle of the evolution of language yet again.
And I think in the evolution of the culture.
Well, language, the change in language is going to reflect a change in the culture. So that's sort of a footnote of what the play is about, is how the culture changed, and to some degree part of the interest is in comparing what is acceptable language now and what would be offensive then. One of the things that usually gets a laugh is the prosecuting attorney, and this is straight from the transcript. He's making a big liberal pronouncement about how people shouldn't be treated differently because of their color. He says just because somebody is born colored by accident, you know,
mm-hmm.
I might have been, you might have been. You know, the concept almost of people's bodies being these receptacles of souls. Now, this was a man who I think thought of himself as, you know, a liberal guy, but every time that line comes out, people go, "Huh? What?"
Exactly. Well, tell me, what happened to the real-life women? Does anyone know?
The only evidence that I have of what happened to them afterwards is that somebody was able to find a reference to Alice Young getting a commendation for service by the end of her stay in the Army. But I even had a private detective at one point looking for them, and could find nothing. You know,
those
weren't the days of the internet or Facebook where everybody advertises what breakfast cereal they're eating. You know?
Well, they probably got married, and then their names kind of disappeared, right?
I wouldn't be surprised. I did find a reference to a woman named Tenola Stoney, who apparently is still alive in Texas, and I got an address, and the age was about right. And I got an address, and I wrote a letter saying, if you are Tenola Stoney, who was involved in this case, I've written this play, and I don't mean to, you know, stir up any unhappy memories, but, you know, if you're inclined to write to me, please do. And I didn't get any reply. But so I don't know if that was the real person. For that matter, I don't know, you know, that she'd be pretty old. Who knows if that is the person, whether or not she was in shape to read the letter.
Yes, exactly.
Wow.
Was death ever really a factor?
Well, I don't think that they were ever seriously going to be threatened with a death sentence, but technically what they did, according to the Army, was desert. Now remember that there were some men in the Port Chicago case, which Nambi refers to in the play, who similarly pulled a strike against the Army, and some of them served 15 years. I can't remember which president finally got around to pardoning them, but you know, 15 years of hard labor, you know, had been meted out to people who had done something very similar recently. So they were putting themselves in danger. And the interesting thing is that they really didn't have to. Both the character that Nambi plays, Alice, and Johnny May, essentially volunteered to be court-martialed, as did the two other women. They were doing it to make a point. They knew what the stakes were, and they felt, this is what I have to do to make this point.
Well, you got to say they're brave.
I'm sorry, Nambi, you were about to say something?
I was just going to say that I think that's kind of, for me, that's what's so powerful about the play, is because you have ordinary people making, you know, essentially sticking to their guns and just making a choice, and that because they make those choices, posterity rides on that. And the whole line that my character, Jenny, says to Tanola about, if you hadn't testified the way you did, I wouldn't be standing here. Like, that's relevant for the character, but it's also relevant for me as a young woman, because those women made those choices that were difficult choices, and yet they made them, I get to stand there and remember them. And what a amazing thing that is, for them to be remembered and honored in that way. And for all the people who stood up and said no to, you know, to ridiculous treatment, you know, from slaves who were brought here to, you know, the people who endured Jim Crow. And it's incredibly relevant, you know, that idea of standing on the shoulders of.
Jim Crow was tantamount to apartheid, really, American apartheid.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I want to ask about Eleanor Roosevelt. How was she instrumental in bringing women into the military, or what was that about?
Well, she was an advocate for the rights of all kinds of people. She was one of the few public voices who spoke against her husband putting the Japanese Americans in internment camps, for instance. She was
really?
She really was unhappy about that.
They didn't put the Germans in there.
Well, but see, it had a racial bias. You know, you couldn't just look at a German and say, oh, that person's a German, but you could look at Asian Americans and say that they were Japanese. So it was absolutely racially based. Mm-hmm. Although there was considerable evidence, in fact, that there was way more anti-American activity on part of some German Americans than there was Japanese Americans, because the Bund was a very big deal, particularly in the Midwest in the late 30s and on into the 40s. And Yorkville was known as a headquarters of a lot of German sympathizers and spies. But she also was particularly insistent on the rights of women. And she pressured the administration, which is to say her husband, to find roles in the military for women, not only because she thought that women would want to participate in the war, but also she was very farsighted. She thought, well, you know, women will get skills in the army that they're not going to get, you know, in kitchens. And they will come out of the army with these skills, and they will be able to enter the workforce. So she was interested in this for all women, but she particularly saw this as an opportunity for black women to gain skills that after the war was over, they would be able to use to be able to get out of kitchens and get into offices and get into different lines of work. So she was, and of course she ended up being involved in this particular case, which is something that, again, I found out reading the papers at the Schomburg Center. You know, it's funny, when I started researching this, I thought, I bet Eleanor Roosevelt was hopping mad about this case. And then, you know, a few weeks later, I read, yes, she was.
Well, yeah, you could see that, especially since it was her idea to bring women into the military. Well, at least she was supportive of it in a big way.
Oh, very, very supportive and very articulate, you know.
Well, I want to ask, and I'm going to step off the subject for a moment, because I want to ask, well, let me ask this question, and then I'll step off the subject. Tell me about your co-stars, Nambi.
Oh, well, we have a fantastic ensemble. It's been such an amazing journey working with this group of people. The woman who plays Tenola Stoney, her name is Jillian Glasgow. And there's also Alia, Shakira Chapman, Evander Duck, Frank Myers, Emma O'Donnell, Ebony Witcher, Keona Welch, Bill Tatum. Bill Tatum is the gentleman who plays all the mean white people. We just have...
He plays a nice white person in there, too. The captain's a nice guy.
Oh, that's right. He's the captain. That's right. For that split second in the motor pool, yes. And also, so we have a fantastic ensemble of actors and definitely supported by Mary Beth Easley, who is our helm. She's our directress. And she's probably one of the most generous directors I think I've ever worked with as an actor. You know, she's just so... kind. It's just like it's beautiful, and it makes it really easy and creates a very safe environment so you can just sort of jump off and try stuff, and she's very approachable. So, and her husband does the sound. His name is Mark Bruckner, and so all of the musical transitions and the a cappella singing that comes in the play was his design. And, of course, we have Bio, our stage manager, and Rosita, her assistant, and just sort of a. This is my first time working at New Federal. And Woody King, and my father have known each other for many, many years, but this is my first time actually working with the company, and I just was really, really grateful for the ensemble that they were able to assemble. It's really been quite a joy. To work with this group of people.
Did you take the play to Woody, or how did Woody get involved?
Well, this is sort of a funny story. Now I have to prove that it's funny. the play was done in Chicago at the Victory Gardens Theater, which for years was my home theater. I did 13 or 14 plays there. And it did pretty well in Chicago. It was nominated for the local award for best play, although it was beaten by a play called August Osage County, which was not a big surprise to me since that's the biggest dramatic hit in American theater in the last 5 years or so. But it was published in a magazine called Dramatics Magazine, which actually goes to high school kids who are interested in the theater. It is not a magazine that people in the theater... in the professional theater know of generally or read. But it's a magazine that I write lots of articles for, and they, you know, said, can we publish this? And I said, sure. And a few weeks after it was published, I got a phone call, and the fellow on the other end says, you don't know me. My name is Woody King, but I just read your play, and I want to do it. I want to do it at my theater, the New Federal. And I said, Mr. King, I've been in the theater here for a long time. Of course I know you. You're a legend. I'm not
exactly
blind and deaf. And I said, but do you know me? You know, do you know who I am? And Woody said, yeah, I know you're white. We're doing the play anyway.
Yeah, well, obviously the Castillo Theater is a white theater.
Well, actually, Castillo, there have been very nice hosts, but this is really really produced by Woody in association with the Castillo.
Yes, exactly.
This has been Woody's obsession for 5 years. And every now and then I'd get a phone call and say, hey, I haven't forgotten you. Oh, okay. And then he'd disappear for 6 months, and then I get another phone call or an email. Haven't forgotten. We're going to do this. Okay. And, you know, it just became something I thought, well, I guess he's still working on it. And then all of a sudden he said, okay, we're going into rehearsal. We're really doing this? He says, yeah, I told you we were going to do this. We're doing this.
Wow. Is that cool?
And actually, the Castillo Theater, I'm not sure about the other founders, but one of the co-founders is named Lenore Filani, and she was the first African-American woman to be on the ballot in all 50 states to run for president in the 80s. So they have
No, she's not. There was a woman from Brooklyn who was the first. I'm trying to think of her name. But do you know who I'm talking about, Mr. Sweet?
I can't say I do. I'm.
I can't think of her name, but she was the first to run for president, first African American woman.
Yeah, well, that's what the theater says, and that's what my father told me, and he's close friends with her for many years. So maybe we're talking about the same person.
Oh, were you talking about Miss Villani?
Yeah. That's what I'm talking about.
As the first African-American woman to run for president.
To be on the ballot, not to run for president, to be on the ballot in all 50 states, which was in the 80s.
Oh.
That's what I said.
Sorry about that.
It's not entirely a white theater, and certainly their roots are, you know, they're very connected, I think, to the theme
the
of
All-Stars.
The play.
The All-Stars is primarily, I think, Hispanic and African-American.
Yeah, those kids, they actually came to the show on Saturday. A bunch of them came. It was really great to do the show for them.
Oh, I bet. Now, I want to step away for a moment and ask you about Blue Shadow.
Oh, yes. That's out of left field. But, yeah, Blue Shadow, actually, my graduate work from Goddard in Vermont is in mythology. And I did a whole bunch of research, and Lifeline Theater in Chicago had said, well, why don't you take this and write a play? So I wrote a play based on my research, and I took mythologies from many different traditions, I think like six different traditions, and I set it around a young girl who was Native American who didn't know her history. So she sort of goes on this journey through these different cultures to sort of figure out where her fit is. And it was actually based on a girl I went to high school with, whose name was Sharon Big Bear, and she unfortunately never figured it out and was murdered when I was in high school.
Oh, geez.
So I wrote the play. She was murdered by a gang. She got involved with gangs, and she had this whole identity crisis, which was very painful to watch, and then she was killed. So I wrote this play in remembrance of her, to honor her. And at the end, the end of the play is the ending that I wish my friend had found, you know, before they got to her. But it's for children.
Right. I saw that you do quite a bit with children, right? You write some children plays?
I have. I'm very passionate about young people and the things that are put into their minds. So I try to write things that are applicable to their lives and certainly things that I wish I had known and been told when I was a child, you know.
When I saw you were also at Lost Boys of Sudan and worked World AIDS Day in Tanzania?
Tanzania. I actually had put together a program with artists from different parts of the world, like from Australia, from Korea, from Germany, and we had all created this project together to work with a theater company in Pangani, Tanzania, and for the World AIDS Day. So our goal was to work with a theater company there and then develop an original piece based on what their experiences were with HIV. And we went there for 3 weeks and we did a workshop. We did a workshop with Anganinge, which was the name of the theater company. But unfortunately, we didn't raise enough money to do the full-out project, but I'm still actually friends with a lot of those people that we met at that workshop, and it really changed my life. I think that was something that it meant a lot to me to be able to go there and to let them know, I think particularly as an African-American woman, that they see Oprah and they see Magic Johnson, but when it's the people on the ground there, a lot of times, most times, they're Caucasian. And so it was so interesting to be in conversation with these African artists and for them to look us in the face and say, you guys have forgotten us. You don't remember who you are, and so you don't help us. Because when we see, you know, the AIDS packages coming and all of the workers from the Peace Corps, if they're from the States or wherever, they're always white. And that was really, like, painful, you know.
Yes.
And then the fact that we didn't raise the money to come back was like, oh, God, you know. But we did our best. And
Well, and it's not too late. I mean, you could work with the UN or something like that to do it. I know people that are working with the UN. In fact, that's how I met Winnie Mandela.
Oh, wow.
She's working with AIDS, too.
Yeah, yes, of course. Did you see the musical, Winnie, the opera, I mean?
No.
Shirley Joe Finney directed.
No,
I didn't. Wow. Yeah, they did like a national, international tour, I guess about a year ago, but just phenomenal. I wish I had seen it. I only saw clips of it, but really just beautiful. Just beautiful things that they
Maybe
did.
Maybe it'll come around again.
I hope so. It needs to be on Broadway and not commercialized, you know.
Well, I also want to say to Mr. Sweet.
Hello.
That I saw that you do musical theater as well, and did you do a production that won an Outer Critics Circle Prize for Best Book and Best Score?
Oh, that's so many years ago. There is an old comedy called Love, spelled L-U-V, which was written by a man named Murray Siskel, who also co-wrote the movie Tootsie. And it was a very funny comedy that I saw when I was a kid. With Alan Arkin and Eli Wallach and Ann Jackson, and some friends of mine were turning it into a musical, and they lost their book writer, and they asked me if I would write it, and I knew it backwards and forwards and from seeing it as a kid and from working on scenes from it in high school. So I said, yeah, I'll do it, and it opened off-Broadway sometime in the early 80s with Nathan Lane before he was a star and Judy Kaye. And it didn't get a very good review from the New York Times. It closed, and the day after we closed, we won the Outer Critics Circle Award for Best Book and Best Score.
Isn't that the way it goes?
So,
but you also, didn't you win, a show you did, won a Peabody?
Oh, that wasn't quite. What happened on that one was that was a TV movie called Pack of Lies, which was based on a play by a man named Hugh Whitmore. And Whitmore wrote the first draft of the screenplay and then got into a fight with the director before the screenplay was usable. And the director was familiar with my work and initially asked me if I'd rewrite a couple of scenes. So I did. And then he said, why don't you rewrite the whole movie? So I did.
Wow.
And Whitmore hated every word that I wrote. I was billed as creative consultant. But Whitmore had the right to sign his name to my work, since he hated it, he signed a pseudonym, and the name Ralph Gallup. And Ralph Gallup ended up being nominated for the Emmy Award. It was my work, but it was his pseudonym.
You were like a ghostwriter.
And then it won a Peabody Award. Well, that's why I'm named creative consultant. If you ever see a project that has somebody credited as creative consultant, that usually means that that's the person who rewrote it. A proper credit would be a co-authorship, because I wouldn't have come up with the idea of the piece on my own. But I thought that he had not done a very good job of adapting his own play to the movies, and I changed a lot of stuff so that it would make a film. But it was a great treat. I went to London to work on it. We shot it in the Pinewood Studios, where all the James Bond movies were shot.
Oh yeah.
And Alan Bates, who was an actor that I admired from when I was a kid, was in the film and turned out to be a lovely man. And Ellen Burstyn. So
wow.
It was. I just sort of stumbled into working on a project that turned out to be a really wonderful project. I've done hundreds of hours of television. But the only hours that I would watch again willingly were the stuff from that show.
But that brought about a very exciting moment in your life.
Well, it was ironic,
you didn't get it directly.
I was sitting in my easy chair watching the Emmy Awards as they ran scenes that I had written. Credited to somebody who didn't exist. Ralph Gallup doesn't exist. So I just had a big laugh about that.
That's a strange irony, right?
Well, the nice thing is that the people who made it were very candid about my having done that, and I started to get work after that from other people. So I ended up doing a fair amount of writing for other people under my own name because the story got around that I had really written that. But
got an Emmy nomination, didn't it?
Yes, but under the name of Ralph Gallup. It was nominated for best TV movie of the year, best script, and best actress. Ellen Burstyn got a nomination. So I was very proud of the piece, and it's available on DVD. And if you buy a copy of it, I will get nothing from it. But
isn't that sad?
It's It's a piece that I'm very proud of, it works. It's a good movie. I sit and watch it sometimes and say, "Oh, look at that! That was good," you know. And it was fun, and I got to go to London. I got to see lots of theater, and I got to work with Alan Bates, and that, you know, that was just great. You know, so it was a very exciting experience, and it led to my doing a lot of writing other television. In fact, Court Martial was originally supposed to be a TV movie.
Get out.
It was originally written for Court TV. Dustin Hoffman's production company commissioned it, and then Court TV went out of business, and I had a script, and nobody was going to shoot it because the whole channel disappeared.
Well, I could see that as a movie, though. It's not too late for it to turn around, right?
Well, I'm hoping that somebody will see the play and say, "Hey, there's a movie in this." And I said, "Just so happens, I have the screenplay," because I do have the screenplay, and it expands a little bit from the play. Do you remember the speech where Lawson is talking about the band that comes to play a dance, and the colonel tries to get the black players thrown out of the band, and the band says, you know, "The hell with this. We're not if our friends can't play, we're not going to play," and they walked out. Well, that was a scene in the movie, but it's also a true story. Now, I obviously couldn't stage it in this play. I could only refer to it. But in the movie version, you see that. That's how we meet Kimball, is him coming into the rec hall and seeing these guys playing and trying to get the black guys thrown out of the job.
Well, so, who would you see playing that role in a movie?
Who, Kimball?
Mm-hmm.
But there are lots of people who would be great. I can see Paul Giamatti being wonderful. You know, one of the keys, and this is something that Bill does beautifully, is that this guy does not know he's a jerk.
He just
doesn't know it. He believes what he's been brought up to believe, and he's acting in a way which he thinks is absolutely reasonable. And I tried to write a speech for him in which he talked about how all these people who grew up in different states, in fact, didn't think of themselves so much as citizens of America, but citizens of their individual states, and they brought their parochial views to the war, and that's in fact pretty true. One of the things, you know, obviously the war was devastating and horrible, and that's what wars are. But one of the things that happened in both World War One and World War Two was that a lot of people who otherwise would have stayed in, you know, their small towns and never experienced anything of the larger world ended up being brought into, seeing something of the larger world. There was a song from World War One, a very popular song called "How Are You Going to Keep Them Down on the Farm After They've Seen Paris?"
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that happened was that a lot of people were yanked out of their very sort of small lives in small towns, seeing people who only looked like them, and they suddenly met all sorts of different kinds of people. Now, some of them stayed prejudiced, and some of them were disabused. Yeah.
Well, I would think that if you're fighting along somebody, tied someone, you have to depend on their person, no matter what color they are.
Yeah, well, but you know the singer-songwriter Melissa Manchester. She's a buddy of mine. In fact, we wrote a musical together. Well, her late father was a friend of mine. He played an instrument, a musical instrument, and he was in an army band. But he and a couple of the other guys were Jewish, and the rest of the guys in his unit were mostly Southern guys who thought the Jews were people who had horns and had tails, which they somehow cleverly, you know, stuck down the legs of their pants. I mean, they really thought, you know, Jews were alien creatures. And rather than have Melissa's father getting beaten up by these people, they segregated the Jewish guys. They put them in a separate tent so that they wouldn't get beaten up by these jerks. Now, in that case, David Manchester was perfectly happy with that because he and the other Jewish musicians, there were about four or five of them, they had their own private tent, and they were away from these guys who kept giving them grief. But,
they were lucky.
But we don't think very much about this play is largely about the segregation of black troops, but here there was segregation of Jewish troops.
Well,
sometimes you notice that they'll say when they're doing their categorizing, they'll say blacks, whites, Hispanic, Jews, like Jews are not white people.
Well, it depends on the Jews. Remember the Jews. It's a term that is very variable. There are black Jews. There are white Jews. Mm-hmm. Jews is not it's not just a religion. It's also a culture. So,
is it an ethnicity?
Well,
some say yes, and others say no.
I would say it's an ethnicity partially because Jews for years tended to intermarry because they weren't allowed to be anywhere near anybody else. You know, Jews were segregated in Russia, for instance, and if you stepped across a line, you could get killed. You'd get killed anyway by the Cossacks, but, Jews didn't intermarry with other races very much until they arrived here in this country. There was a lot of intermarriage within that culture, but it's my mother's Jewish. My father was very WASPy and came from a very WASPy background. But my mother is Jewish, and so in the eyes of the state of Israel, I'm Jewish. Not that I intend to take them up on it, but I'm not a religious Jew. I'm a cultural Jew, which is to say that I identify with, Lenny Bruce and Nichols and May and Shelley Berman and Mort Saul and Philip Roth and George Gershwin. These are the people that I feel a particular kinship with. And Leonard Bernstein, our God.
And the artist. But I want to come back to the play for a moment because I want to tell people where they can get tickets.
Yeah.
Well, as we mentioned before, the New Federal Theater, you can call 212-353-1176. Or if you want to go online, you can call www.newfederaltheater.org, or you can look it up at www.newfederaltheater.org. Or also, for tickets, you can call 212-941-1234. I think that's the Castillo box office. And or online for Castillo is www.castillo.org, and that's CASTILLO.org. And the name of the play is Court Martial at Fort Devon, and it's at 543 West 42nd Street. And it's a long walk between 10th and 11th, but you can get the bus.
Well, it's between 10th and 11th Avenue, but one of the things which I realized, which is kind of exciting, is that if you take a look at the blocks on 42nd Street between 9th and 11th Avenue, there are something like 16 stages there. It's kind of extraordinary. When I first came to this town, that area was where you were massage parlors and places where you bought drugs, and it was a very dangerous area. And now what do you have there? You have 16 stages.
Including Schubert Theater.
Yeah, there's all over the place. I mean, there's amazing stuff going on, and it's been, theater transforms neighborhoods. As soon as you get two or three theaters, all of a sudden restaurants open up and people come to visit, and the people who work in the theaters live nearby. And I'm a big belief in the transformative power of theater, both on stage and off.
Hmm. Indeed. And we're going to end the show shortly, but I want to say to Nambi that I talked to the filmmaker that did Emmett Till.
The
documentary, and I saw that you were involved in the ballot of Emmett Till. That's another horrific story.
Yeah, I was actually just thinking about that today during the course of this conversation, because I was thinking about the young boy in Florida that was killed. Was it Trayvon is his name?
Oh, yes.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
And, you know, all the buzz on the online is that it's a modern-day Emmett Till, and what are we going to do about it, and when does it stop? And thinking about young people and how vulnerable they are, you know.
Indeed.
But we did that play at the Goodman. Aoife Baeza is the playwright. Os Scott directed it. And it had a 13-person cast. And then Aoife, after the run at the Goodman, she decided to scale it down to a cast of 5. And
wow,
they had a run at the Fountain Theater in Los Angeles, and I guess it had like a 5-month run. I mean, people went crazy over it. And actually, right now they're doing stage readings of with the cast that did it in L.A. They're doing stage readings of it for young people. And someone wrote online from the cast today that one of the young people said afterwards, "It's like, well, how can racism end?" You know, that was the question that the child asked. And you know, so they put it to Facebook. How can we end this? What can we do?
Well, I think the media, I've noticed when you look at TV now, they have more people of color on television than ever before. You see interracial dating like you've never used to see that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I think little by little, if the media starts teaching people, you know, we're all one, and that's the bottom line. We are all one.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree with you. I think it's so much on the media and how much the media spins these stories, whether or not it inflames things or it squelches it, you know.
Well, we need to be more positive. I think the media has become way too negative, and we need to start making people feel good about themselves instead of depressed.
Yep, I agree. I agree 100%.
Well, folks, we are near the end of the show. Is there anything I haven't asked that you would like to say, or have we covered it all?
Well, I just would like to say that one of the happiest things about this experience for me is I knew of NAMBI because we both had done a lot of work in Chicago theater, but the pleasure of really getting to work with her is one of the things that I'm really going to take away from this, is one of the happiest aspects of doing this. So this has been, you know, aside from being a professional pleasure, it's been a great personal pleasure.
Oh, I'm smiling. Thank you.
And what do you take away from the play, NAMBI?
You know, pretty much the same thing. It's funny that there was the American Theater online on Facebook today. That was the question: is the playwright in the room in your rehearsal, and was it a good thing? And I was going to write Jeffrey Sweet, a corps marshal at Fort Devens, and at the New Federal Theater, who's in rehearsal, and it's been a blast. I mean, I've never had a playwright be there so much, and then also be in tech, and to not be like, you know, to be such a part of the process that you actually miss them when they're gone, you know, because sometimes playwrights get so upset, you know, they're always upset, you know, so it's nice to have somebody just always stroking us and being supportive, and also, you know, Jeff is mentoring me because I write, and I will tell you, Jeff, I implemented a lot of your ideas today in terms of each scene, and my play ends with a strong decision. And it's like night and day. So thank you. I spent my whole day at the library today doing that. So
well,
thank
I'm very
you.
Flattered. Thank you.
Thank you for making my play better.
I
want to thank you both for making this show wonderful. And the clock has wound down, and unfortunately we have to say goodbye. So I do say goodbye. But it has been a very interesting show. And we have been talking to NAMBI Kelly and Jeffrey Sweet, so I again suggest you go run to the box office and get those tickets. Run, don't walk. And again, you could call 212-941-1234 to get tickets. And I want to thank my audience for making my topic topically yours. And we're going to end the show with the Army Song. And thank you again, Mr. Sweet.
Thank you.
Ms. Kelly.
Thank you. Thank you.
Bum 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 bum.
March along, bum, bum, sing our song, bum, 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 with the army of the free.
Bum bum
count the brave, count the bum bum bum. Who have fought to victory? We're the army and proud of our name.
Our name.
We're the army and proudly proclaim.
First to fight for the right and to build the nation's might.
And the army is rolling along.
Yes, we're proud of all we have done, fighting battles and battles won.
And the army is rolling along.
And
then it's high, high, hey, the army's on its way. Count off the cadence, that is strong.
And the army goes rolling along, along.
And this is the Blake Radio Network, Rainbow Soul.